Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melbourne reporting another nation joins airstrikes against Islamic State in Syria. Turkish fighter jets have carried out their first airstrikes as part of the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State group in Syria. That according to a foreign ministry statement. The aircraft began attacking IS targets late Friday across the border in Syria that were deemed to be threats to Turkey. After months of delay, Turkey agreed last month to take on a more active role in the fight against Islamic State extremists. Police in Thailand say they've arrested a suspect in connection with the August 17th bomb attack in Bangkok that killed at least 20 people. Police spokesman said the suspect was arrested Saturday on the outskirts of Bangkok after police found possible bomb-making materials at an apartment he had rented. VOA correspondent Steve Herman of Bangkok says a police official has identified the suspect as 28-year-old Turkish national Adam Karadag.
Police are saying that they have arrested a foreign man who was found in an apartment on the eastern outskirts of the capital. And in his room was a lot of suspicious materials, including explosives, pipes, and other items that they believe can be used to make bombs.
However, Herman says the man taken into custody is not believed to be the bomber seen leaving a backpack at the scene of the incident. The search for others involved continues. No one has claimed responsibility yet for the Bangkok bombing, which took place at the popular Erawan Shrine in central Bangkok. Authorities say a number of tourists were among the victims. Scores more people were wounded in that blast. You can find out more on this story at voanews.com. This is VOA News. An Egyptian court has found three Al Jazeera journalists guilty of supporting the banned Muslim Brotherhood and has sentenced them to 3 years in prison. The Cairo court announced the verdicts and the sentences of the retrial Saturday. Mustafa Saoug, Al Jazeera's media network's acting director, said in a statement that today's verdict defied logic and common sense. Judge Hassan Farid, in handing down the sentences, said the journalist had equipment that had not been approved by Egyptian security officials and said the men were spreading what was called false news and had used their hotel as a broadcast center without permission. Human rights lawyer Amal Clooney criticized the sentences.
The verdict today sends a very dangerous message in Egypt. It sends a message that journalists can be locked up for simply doing their job, for telling the truth and reporting the news. And it sends a dangerous message that there are judges in Egypt who will allow their courts to become instruments of political repression and propaganda.
Clooney represented Canadian national Mohamed Fahmy, who was Al Jazeera's acting bureau chief in Cairo. Fahmy was sentenced along with Australian journalist Peter Grest and Egyptian producer Baher Mohamed. Clooney added that she hoped Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi would pardon the three journalists. Australian police are saying that they have rescued three young children suffering from severe dehydration who were close to death from a van in Austria, along with 23 other migrants from Syria, Afghanistan, and Bangladesh. The incident occurred Friday, a day after the bodies of 71 refugees were discovered decomposing in an abandoned vehicle on a road between Vienna and Budapest. The two girls and one boy, aged 5 and 6, were in critical condition when police stopped the van after a high-speed chase close to the town of St. Peter am Harz on the German border, according to Austrian police. They are now hospitalized and are recovering. Meanwhile, four men suspected of involvement in the deaths of the 71 refugees found Thursday were placed under preliminary arrest by a Hungarian court. The three Bulgarian suspects are aged 29, 30, and 50, according to officials. A fourth, an Afghan, is 28. The U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice has arrived in Islamabad on an unscheduled visit for talks with senior Pakistani government and military officials. Pakistani officials who asked not to be identified told VOA that Rice will meet with Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif on Sunday. VOA's IS Gul reports Pakistani officials said they will emphasize during the meetings with Rice that direct meetings between the Kabul government and the Taliban must resume quickly. I'm Ira Melman, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
Yes, fellow soldiers, the government soldiers are actually ordered not to fire or not to go for any offensive, except when they are attacked, they can stand by. So this is the start of the implementation.
The South Sudanese government and rebels implement a peace agreement Saturday.
The event is highly awaited, not only in the Red Lam, but people are coming from different places of the country to the capital to see what is going to happen. But some other people will be watching on live on television and listening to radios.
In Tanzania, the main opposition Chadema Party officially launches its campaign today ahead of the upcoming general election.
Now we are looking at creating an operational national agency which will encompass the real operational work in a coordinated way under one umbrella. Other than simply being able to do the monitoring, we do the real operational work.
And Uganda grapples with finding a solution to resolve human trafficking problems. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. First phase of South Sudan's peace agreement signed between the government and the rebels to end the 20-month conflict goes into effect Saturday. Attorney spokesman for President Salva Kiir says the administration in Juba is committed to the full implementation of the accord despite reservations about the agreement. He told me the agreement violates the country's sovereignty.
Although the president did sign with reservations, after 24 hours of the signing, that was on 27, the president of the republic issued a presidential order, number 35 of 2015, declaring permanent ceasefire in the implementation of the compromise peace deal, and that it came to effect on midnight of the 27th and 28th, respectively, and that Yes, fellow soldiers, the government soldiers are actually ordered not to fire or not to go for any offensive, except when they are attacked, they can stand by. So this is the start of the implementation.
So how committed is President Kiir to the agreement, particularly when he expressed reservations about the peace deal that he signed?
President Salva Kiir and the government of the Republic of South Sudan are willing to implement the peace agreement, with the exception of those reservations, because, those reservations are a matter of sovereignty. And by telling the president to implement them, fully, you are suggesting that, Republic of South Sudan shouldn't be a sovereign country and should be a country that is under the mandate of the United Nations if those reservations are removed. But the president is willing to implement all what he did not express observation on it, the exception of those observations.
But the United Nations has said it will consider appropriate targeted sanctions against anybody that undermines the peace accord. Now, you talked about the fact that the reservations about sovereignty, does that mean that the president will not implement in total the peace agreement?
Yeah, once you've come to the understanding of the international community, the fact that, by trying to mediate on a peace process between the warring parties, need also to be vigilant, understand those points that has led into a certain party, or expressing observation, because you wanted to bring the problem to an end. The threat of limited sanction or threat of sanctions does not solve the problem. It will only serve to aggravate the situation. South Sudan is so delicate to the extent that if it is sanctions, the whole country can collapse. And if it collapses, then it will be only the rule of anarchy, and which the international community will not be able to control. We have the international community, understand the fact that those reservations are actually crucial in the implementation of this peace deal, simply because we wanted to implement something that we have accepted fully, simply because he doesn't impinge. Those toys are not impinging on South Sudan sovereignty.
What's next after the peace deal is signed? What's going to happen next?
The president has addressed the nation and the whole world on the way of signing. And he is going to also address the nation in the few coming week or days to tell the people that, you know, it is necessary that we must start implementing what we have signed for. And what next is that I have seen the rebel leader has replicated the same thing. On Friday, he also declared the ceasefire and the cessation of hostilities. Now, it will be incumbent upon the two leaders of the two factions, the two fighting parties, I mean, the president and commander-in-chief here and the rebel leader, Riek Machar, now implementing in letter and in spirit, that the ceasefire will have to be a real ceasefire, that there are no people who come out on rampage to attack the other. The government forces are going to stay, and they will adhere to the orders given to them by commander-in-chief of the SCLA.
Attorney Work Attorney is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Tanzania's main opposition Chadema political party earlier today officially launched its campaign for the October 25th general election in the commercial capital Dar es Salaam. Tumaini Makeni, Chadema party spokesman, told me his group aims to present a united front with other opposition parties known as UKAWA to challenge and break the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi or CCM party's dominance.
So we are launching a campaign. Actually, it's going to be one of the very historical moments during this historical election. The event is highly awaited, not only in Dar es Salaam, but people are coming from different places of the country to the capital to see what is going to happen. But some other people will be watching on live broadcasting, on live on television, and listening to radios.
Former Prime Minister Lowassa will be adored as the person to represent Chadema in the election, and other prominent former members of the CCM will be present as part of the campaign. What can you tell me about this?
Chadema has been a very, very, very influential political party. Having a lot of hopes of carrying hopes of people on their shoulders as we are heading to these historical elections in Tanzania. So, including the big shots from CCM, we've been able to defect, but Chadema, as it stands, on itself, it is a big brand which is going to make a big difference.
Talking about UKAWA, which is supposed to be the opposition alliance, you're supposed to have the same presidential candidate representing all opposition parties. How would you reconcile this since Mr. Lowassa appears to lead the party for the presidential election?
Yeah, it is true. Chadema has been entrusted by the political parties which are forming the UKAWA coalition, which is a coalition for constitutional, as far as you mentioned. But we don't see anything like challenging UKAWA to move forward. We've been able to go in a big percentage to agree or to have a good consideration in terms of having one candidate. And UKAWA is only formed by four many opposition parties, which is Chadema, CUF, NCC Mageuzi, and NLD. So far the big challenge was to have one which some people could not even believe that it would be possible, but it has been impossible, is to have one candidate for the presidential post. But that has been able to jump that big barrier.
From what we expect as your official presidential campaign or general campaign, how confident are you that Chadema could lead the opposition to wrestle power from the dominance of the CCM, which has been in power basically since 1961, since Tanzania gained independence from Britain?
I would wish to answer this question with hasty laughter. If we could be here in Tanzania, and especially in big cities and in local levels, down the grassroots in the villages, you could see how Chadema have been able to make a very big difference in this kind of politics for the past 10 years. And you could even witness with your eyes how much CCM is losing influence to the people. I can tell you CCM has lost in political influence, not only political influence, but CCM has been able to lose legitimacy, political legitimacy, which is very much important to in politics, to lose political legitimacy. Meanwhile, Chadema has been able to gain and gain and gain political legitimacy to the Tanzanian people.
Tumaini Makene is the spokesman for Tanzania's main opposition Chadema party. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. Zimbabwean opposition movement for democratic change formation led by former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is calling for a stimulus package to boost the country's faltering economy. Saddled with a debt overhang of more than $8 billion, the MDCT says the country can only move forward if additional funding is injected into the economy. For VOA, Thomas Chiripasi has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The MDCT's Economic Affairs Secretary, Webber Chinyadza, told a news conference at his party's Harvest House headquarters in the capital today that Zimbabwe's national economic output has not surpassed a high recorded in 1972 before the country attained its independence, a situation he blamed on President Robert Mugabe's poor governing policies. Chinyadza said the ruling ZANU-PF government has failed to come up with sound economic policies, adding that Zimbabwe now needs a stimulus package to revitalize its productive sectors of the economy that are operating far beyond capacity.
The stimulus package is absolutely necessary. The difficulty actually arises out of the lack of confidence which is generated by the existing government. They don't inspire any confidence to the international community who can actually put together a stimulus package on our behalf.
Noting that the country's economy is agro-based, the opposition official says it is disheartening that authorities allocated a paltry sum of money to the agricultural sector in this year's cropping season budget to finance irrigation schemes at a time when rainfall patterns have changed due to climate change.
A significant number of irrigation projects are moribund. To allocate a mere $1.6 million for irrigation schemes in a nation beset with drought problems is criminal, to say the least.
Studio 7 failed to get a comment from ZANU-PF spokesperson Simon Kayamoyo, who said he was attending the official opening of the Harare Agricultural Show, where Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi was officiating. However, President Robert Mugabe told Zimbabweans in his State of the Nation address that Zimbabwe's economy was poised for a major takeoff in keeping with the country's economic blueprint, Zim Asset, promising that his government was going to prioritize value addition on agricultural products and enacting policies that promote and attract foreign direct investment. Former government chief economist Masimba Manyanya says more needs to be done before Zimbabwe gets a stimulus package.
It's the stabilization package from the IMF and the World Bank. We all know when these things started in 1990, we ended up in real serious trouble. Stabilization packages have to be well designed. A stabilization package is something that normally comes into an economy when you have ensured that you have developed the core sectors of the economy and you can protect them from the harsh effects of market reform. Market reform always comes with very, very difficult precedents. And where we are right now, if you were to ask me, we have to sort out the political variables, the political governance issues.
Meanwhile, Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa yesterday pleaded for a cash bailout from the World Bank, saying Zimbabwe has not received a single cent from the Bretton Woods institution in the last 10 years. But Guan Zhengchen, the World Bank's country director for 7 Southern African countries, including Zimbabwe, told Chinamasa that the Zimbabwean government needed to demonstrate that it is serious in addressing the macroeconomic and investment challenges that the country is facing. Some foreign investors are reportedly shunning Zimbabwe because they are not happy with the black empowerment regulations that compel all foreign-owned businesses to cede at least 51% of their shareholding to black Zimbabweans. Manyanya says government also needs to ensure that investors' money is safe in Zimbabwe.
Such a request can only be made in the context of a certain of some political values. You can't just start asking for a bailout, a cash bailout from the World Bank at a time when you have been shouting at the very same people. So I always go back to the issue of alignment between our political values and what we see as the issues that directly affect our economic livelihood.
Zimbabwe's external debt overhang is hovering at $8.4 billion, and the country has failed to clear its arrears in order to access fresh lines of credit to service its economy. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
Rwandan-born Jean Bosco Nzeyimana has won awards for his inventions. One is a way of composting household trash into cleaner cooking fuel for poor families. He was in Washington, D.C. recently as a Mandela Washington Fellow, as one of 100 of Africa's best young thinkers and actors. Viewers Pauline Dio has more on the story.
21-year-old Jean Bosco Nzeyimana is the founder and CEO of Habona Limited, a Rwandan startup trying to address the lack of electricity in his rural village of Kitabi. He is part of a new breed of young African innovators trying to change Rwanda's image.
I have a company back home called the Habona Limited. It does a lot of work regarding waste management, whereby we collect waste, and after collecting the waste, we use them to produce affordable and environmentally friendly products in the form of biomass briquettes.
Jean Bosco's fascination with biogas started when he was a young boy, and his vision to create a biogas plant that can transform organic waste into flammable gas that can be distributed to the local population for their energy needs. He is partnering with the government to collect household trash, which he then sells as cleaner, cheaper source of cooking fuel for poor families in Rwanda.
I grew up just thinking about what I can do for my family. So I came up with the idea of taking advantage of waste and use them to produce these kind of fuels, which are actually better for the lives of people.
In his village, he's just a regular guy. In fact, very few people know about his innovation that is generating a buzz on the international scene. Jean Bosco was crowned last year as the winner of the Africa Innovation Prize and also recognized in 2014 as a top young entrepreneur in Rwanda.
Being recognized as the top young entrepreneur of Rwanda was very, very good for me because, you know, it showed me that I'm doing meaningful things. It showed me that, you know, what I do is really impactful to the community, and it gave me some sense of, like, motivation.
For a rising biogas, a firm like Habona Limited, partnering with the right people in the business can definitely go a long way, as he plans to construct a biogas plant in his native country. While here in the United States, Jean Bosco attended Northwestern University for 6 weeks as part of the yearly fellowship. Dr. Mavi Norman served as a peer collaborator for Jean Bosco.
Bosco is an amazing, amazing young gentleman. Since I met him about 6 weeks ago, he's just shown to be a very serious, very focused, very diligent, very charismatic young man, and I'm certain that he is going to make some serious strides in Rwanda, but even beyond, throughout Africa.
Despite his early success, the young entrepreneur is focused on perfecting his innovation. He attributes his accomplishment to hard work.
Yeah. What does success mean to you?
Yeah, When people look at me, they say this young man is successful, and they say, you know, he has won a lot of prizes, he has done this, but that doesn't mean success to me. For me, success is what I do to promote my society. Success means what I'm doing, how I'm working hard at my company.
The full implementation of this project will enable his company, Habona, to distribute biogas and biofertilizer to more than 500,000 households. For a young man whose dreams are big, the sky is the limit. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
A recent report by the U.S. State Department highlighted the problems Uganda continues to have with human trafficking. While efforts are being made to stop the practice, realities such as social media and rampant underemployment are getting in the way. For VOA, Elizabeth Paula reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Human trafficking in Uganda usually starts with a message from a distant friend, offering easy work, plenty of money, and free transit to exotic locations. Many Ugandans have found these promises hard to turn down. Shakira, who asked that her last name not be used, was told by a friend who had moved to the United Arab Emirates that a job was waiting for her in Dubai. When she arrived, she found something entirely different.
So after some time, my friend disappeared after something like 3 days. And then came in a lady. The lady was like, I'm the one who invested my money in you to come here. Mm-hmm. And the only way to pay me back, you have to sell off yourself. I was like, I can't do that. So they tortured me so much. They denied me food. I slept outside the house for 3 weeks.
Shakira was kept in a house with 14 other girls, all from Uganda. Eventually, she was able to formulate an escape plan with two other girls and made her way back home. It is a story that is familiar to Moses Benoga, the head of Uganda's counter-trafficking and persons office, and his deputy coordinator, Agnes Egoye. The State Department praised the task force for raising awareness about human trafficking and providing training for police and immigration officials. In addition, the persecution of traffickers has gone up. Benoga says to continue this trend, they must expand the capacities of the task force.
Now we are looking at creating an operational national agency, which will encompass the real operational work in a coordinated way under one umbrella. Other than simply being able to do the monitoring, and we do the real operational work, do the investigations, we do the rescue, we do the support of the victims, and also carry out the awareness. That is the vision where we are driving to.
Egoye urges Ugandans to heed the warning signs.
The red flags are, if somebody says, I'm going to give you the money, which will purchase your passport, I'm going to give you money, which will purchase your air ticket, which will buy you food, you'll pay me when you get your first salary. That's a red flag.
Yeah.
Never leave the country when you are indebted.
The task force is hoping those warnings, along with cooperation from Ugandan law enforcement agencies, will reduce human trafficking in Uganda. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from African Collection. Enjoy.
Napenda tupenda nupendi tupenda ne kwa nini Toto zangu zote ni moja kuishi na wenyumbani Natuma yoka we saluri Kata mokuvoli We angamba tinotolio Baliru dawa ani Tatizo unafikiri ya mimi ni masikini Umukwano vangu siku wa kuichiza ukolomoni Siri na mula la bendo osa Kambula, chima polo mala benzita, anina kupenda sana, oh, nje ya katunda kuleyo, chakaranka nye kongoli wano, sabo yitenga nzepao, kalichima kusa ujeno, chana kukamba kusengao, lafu ye ya njalo lingango, masima nusu sana mko, oh, 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 oh. Ujue, nakuwaza usiku na mchana.
Who's your hand? Body man, chameleon. Emanuela in me. Hero, who may choke a lot of it up below. You might have a good enough for some good. Best another money at the people.
Sasa musango, mwami sasa musango, kwesi kwa mungu ni mungu. bacho tulise mede noma na ye mukama chafanga mubantuwe ndi kulekane mfuna ye na wayange oya mwani
that's no opportunity. Show me the way how to live out a calamity. Show me the way how to live better, to live better. Ipate maisha mazuri, watoto wasome vizuri, wapate chakula nzuri. Kinyata kabila kagami wali 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 wali. Kuna wale wale wali shabandikiwa na Mungu wale 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 wali shapenda zaidi yule yule wale 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 wale.
Music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to take time to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on an attitude toward the United States. This week, I believe the whole question of America's contribution to health issues in Africa demands greater attention again. During this analysis, it is important to identify how U.S.-African relations have real changes in many parts of Africa since independence. Anyone who is interested in this field of research can devote a great deal of time listing the number of African graduates in medicine and other scientific topics across the United States. If you go back to the history of Africans who came to the United States to study scientific and technological knowledge to bring about changes in their country, you can see how the numbers were very small at the beginning of the 20th century and how today we have a larger number of Africans who came to the United States. One can divide that number into two or three groups. If you look at the political leadership in Africa, you see how many of them who came from 1900 to the year 2000. And if you look at those who were trained in the United States in the field of political studies, you have an outstanding number of people who can be identified with regard to America and African political development. But one could very well talk about America and African scientific development in the field of medicine and health. When we talk about these personalities in the political field, of course, Namdi Azikiwe, Kwame Nkrumah are always identified as leading lights who came to study here. But there were others who came from East Africa. And today, when we talk about the legacies of President Obama, we identify his father among those who came here and they studied the social sciences, went back home and became economists, political scientists, public administrators, accountants, and others. But you can also talk about those who are medical personalities who contributed to the development of Africa. Someone who is not always mentioned was Hosting Banda of Malawi. So when we talk about the young people who came here over the last 100 years from Africa, there are a lot of people who are not remembered, but they are very much part of the Africans who came to America and studied medicine and went back home. There are Liberians, Sierra Leoneans, Gambians, people from the Francophone countries who came particularly after independence. But before independence, people like Hastings Banda of Malawi, who deserves to be remembered, because he was a doctor who came, and he belonged to a generation of African doctors who studied in the United States. In his particular case, his biography does not only deal with America's contribution in medicine, but he was one of the very few Africans who studied medicine and was also politically engaged in African history. So, Kamuzu Bande belonged to those people who has both political and medical links to America. So when young Africans in the universities in Africa look at African doctors who came out of America during this particular period, Banda will be identified. And interestingly, much as we celebrate Kwame Nkrumah and Namdi Azikiwe and a whole number of people who came out of East Africa, Central Africa, the Arab Congolese, who came after the time of Lumumba, there are many African political scientists and others who are very much linked to this narrative. And when we look at those Africans who are doctors, Hastings Kamuzu Banda is the one who is both political and medical. And his story could be elaborated. I could talk a longer time, because when you look at Banda, you can see the Banda experience with regard to America's contribution to Africa. But there are a lot of young people who came out of East Africa, South Africa, Central Africa, North Africa, and West Africa. So when you conclude this narrative, one can say that the best relations with Africa is not only in the field of social science. And the late Ali Mazrui, when he was talking about Greece in African political thought, talk about how people like Kwame Nkrumah and many other Africans who were educated in America carry with them many of the legacies and contributions from America to Africa. So most of our experts who know medicine in Africa and can look at the contribution of America in African medicine, you can see how you can come up with a very elaborate study of medicine, America, and the African experience. And this is a topic that can be the debate among those who are blogging and writing about America and Africa in medical development. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a wise man who knows proverbs can always reconcile difficulties. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Despite an agreement by militant groups there to disarm, sporadic violence continues in the Central African Republic. In the most recent incident, some 42 people traveling by truck in central CAR were killed in an ambush August 24th. Gunmen forced the vehicle to stop by shooting its tires, then its passengers, as it entered a village northeast of the capital, Bangui. The United States is committed to working with others in the international community to prevent further destabilization in CAR and to bring peace and security to its people. To that end, the U.S. Treasury Department has imposed sanctions against three men leading groups threatening the peace, security, and stability there. Action was also taken against a diamond company and its Belgian affiliate that are helping fuel the violence through an illicit trade in CAR's natural resources. Any assets these individuals and entities may have under U.S. jurisdiction are now frozen, and Americans are generally prohibited from doing business with them. Sanctioned were Alfred Yekatum, commander of anti-Balaka forces in and around Bangui, suspected of conducting an ethnic cleansing campaign against Muslims; Habib Susu, an anti-Balaka commander who has repeatedly threatened Muslims and organizations distributing food aid to them; and Umar Yunus, a senior Seleka commander involved in an illicit diamond trade. Badika, one of the largest diamond companies in the CAR, and Cardiam, Badika's branch in Antwerp, Belgium, were sanctioned for making illicit payments to Seleka leaders to obtain diamonds from mines under the group's control and smuggle them out of the country. The sanctions, which are in line with sanctions measures taken at the United Nations Security Council, follow several steps our nation is taking to address the critical needs in the CAR. The United States strongly supports the transitional government and the efforts of the people of CAR to find lasting peace and security. Over the past 2 years, we have committed more than $800 million in humanitarian aid, peacekeeping support, and investments in reconciliation and rule of law. Ultimately, however, the people of CAR hold their future in their own hands. We continue to urge all parties to end the violence, prepare and participate in the elections process, refrain from supporting spoilers whose motives are counter to long-term stability and peace, and move ahead toward a better future for their nation and people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.